because he told Pilate that his kingdom was not of this world. If his kingdom was of this world, then his servants would fight. But it's not. So we don't learn to fight that way. We don't learn to fight like Joseph Smith did. We learn to beat our swords into plowshares. We're farmers. We're planting seed. We're reaping the harvest. That's our job. So keep that in mind when you think about Revelation, the historical approach. This historical approach is good too, because you remember we've talked before. I mean, not necessarily me, but I'm sure you've studied before the Thessalonian letters. And one of the points that we notice when we study those is that in 1 Thessalonians, the Apostle Paul mentioned several times the coming of our Lord. And I'm sure they were excited about it. They were anxious for the coming of the Lord. And that could have had a bearing then on 2 Thessalonians, where he had told them in the first letter to make sure you work. Study to be quiet. Work with your own hands. But by the time of the 2 Thessalonian letter, he's going to have to warn them, some of you aren't working at all. And as a result, you're becoming busybodies in other people's business. You need to work. And if you don't work, then the church should withdraw from you. That's where that expression comes from. Withdraw from them, those that walk disorderly, working not at all. Walking disorderly there meant they weren't working. They had a disorderly life. When you have a job, you have order in your life. When you don't have a job, when you don't have obligations, your life can easily become disorderly, and it can lead to different sins. So it's good to have order in your life. But in that letter, some have wondered if maybe some of them, whether it was the way they really thought or if it was just an excuse, they were thinking, well, if the Lord's coming any time now, what's the point in working? And we've seen that in history where a religious group follows a certain teacher and the teacher says, I have figured out from the Bible that Jesus is coming next week. Well, they just stop working. They camp out. And they wait, maybe up on a mountain, they wait for the Lord to come. Kind of like people waiting for the UFOs to come. We're here. We greet you. We welcome you. But they had that idea with Jesus that they were going to welcome Jesus to come back. And that's not the way it's going to happen, Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 2. He says, don't let anyone disturb you about this. As though we said it or we wrote it in a letter, that day of the Lord will not come until there's a falling away first. Falling away is where you get the word apostasy. The church will fall away. And that's what the history of the church has been. If I was alive in the first century, I would have wanted Jesus to come right away. I wouldn't have thought that the world would stand for 2,000 years. I wouldn't have thought that. I don't know how many people would have thought that in the first century. Because you could look around then and see that the world was wicked, couldn't you? The Roman Empire had a lot of wickedness in it. You'd say, how much longer can God put up with these people and your own nation? How much longer can God put up with our stiff-necked and rebellious ways? So you could have thought a lot of reasons. I just don't think the world's going to stand much longer. So when you hear that today, just remember, yes, there is wickedness. Don't deny that or minimize it, but don't think that because there's wickedness, that must mean the Lord's coming any time. Remember that when Jesus talked about that in the gospel accounts, Matthew 25, among others, he said that it's going to be like it was in the days of Noah and like it was in the days of Lot. And what he meant by that was not that it was wicked, it was, but what he meant was he said they'll be eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. So it's a description of life's ordinary routines. Yeah. The status quo. Everything will be going along just fine. Nobody's going to be thinking when Jesus comes around, oh, I think he's coming now. Or I think he's coming today or this year. Nobody's going to be thinking that unless you're a Christian. then you'll be ready at any time. You'll be ready today if he comes. That's the way we're supposed to think. But Jesus is saying that's why you have to watch and pray, because nobody knows the day nor the hour when the Son of Man will return. That one group that was around in 1988, and I haven't heard any more out of them, they wrote a book, 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 1988. And they had 88 reasons in the book. They looked like math problems. It was, you take this year in the Bible, you subtract this year in the Bible, you add this year, multiply by 3, what do you get? 1988. Whoa! Pretty good. And there were 88 of those things, which was pretty impressive. Whoa. It's not just 10 reasons why he'll come in 88 or 20. It's 88 reasons? Ah, that's pretty convincing. But again, if some of you aren't like me, but if you're like me and you're not good at math, you're kind of intimidated by math anyway. Well, he sounds like he's pretty good with math. Yeah, maybe he's got a point. But it was funny, the people that promoted this, they took the week off before they thought it was going to happen, which I thought was kind of funny. Why do you take the week off before Jesus comes back? What's the point in that? I don't quite follow that. Yeah, I think they did. Have a vacation, yeah. Do the things you never got to do. Wait. I guess the only way out of that one is if they believe their pets were going to heaven, too. There are people believe that now, too. So. Yep, that's right. Dad? Do you know if he ever explained what happened in 88? I wonder what his explanation was. I remember when the Jehovah's Witnesses said that it would be all over in 1975. I asked two of them after that on two different times. I asked how they explain that, because, you know, the Watchtower to them is God's organization, and it can't be wrong if it's God's organization. And they said, we found the guys that promoted that, and we excommunicated them. Yeah, but you guys follow that organization. You put it on the level of inspiration. It's like a prophet, and yet they misled you. They deceived you, yeah, but that doesn't discourage them. They keep on going. And another one, the other one had a different answer. It wasn't the same. So I imagine they probably didn't discuss it much. Or at least they won't let us know what their discussions were. But the point here is, and it goes along with what Wade is saying about people will take advantage of this very kind of thinking. When the disciples ask in Matthew 24, when Jesus said the temple's going to be destroyed, they said, when's this going to happen? What's Jesus' first response? He doesn't give them a time. He says, make sure no one fools you. That's the words of Jesus. We are followers of Christ. We follow what he says. Don't let anyone fool you. Because many will rise up in my name. Many will rise up in my name and will deceive, oh, maybe a couple of people here. No, they'll deceive many. So don't let anybody fool you. And how do we get fooled? Like what Wade says, that it's along those lines. They will take advantage of current events. Any disaster, any thing that's being predicted that's going to happen, they will take advantage of that and say, see? That must mean the Lord's coming at any moment now. See, this is a terrible thing. Remember global warming is the impending disaster that is being promoted by many. Yep. No, I agree that's a factor in this. I think one of the terms is management by crisis. Management by crisis. People know there's a crisis, they're open to suggestions. Academics and laws. Yep. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true. It is in academics too. So, Jesus' words are exactly right, aren't they? Don't let anybody fool you. You're following me, but if they take advantage of these crises that come along, you might stop following. You might follow somebody else. So that's a wonderful thing about this, that we are warned, and Jesus helps us with that. Another example of that is, some of you remember the Hale-Bopp comet and the followers. Does anybody remember the name of that group? Yeah, Heaven's Gate. Thank you, Eric. Heaven's Gate. And at that point, at the one gathering of the Heaven's Gate group, there were 39, I think, that were convinced by the leader that that Hale-Bopp comet, see how unusual it is? How often does this happen? You know, this is really unusual. This is kind of scary, isn't it? Well, what this means is there's a spaceship out there, and that if you are willing to take your life, you can advance to the next level. You'll be brought onto that spaceship. And they believed that. The man who did that claimed that he was Christ. He had a girlfriend, or I don't know if they ever got married or not, but he claimed she was God. She was God, he was Christ. Isn't that clever? Isn't that progressive and up to date? The man will be the Christ, and the woman will be God, the Father. It's in keeping with the times, I think. That's what's so clever about that. Even though on the surface it just sounds so foolish. But yet that's what he was. There were people that followed that. It wasn't thousands, it wasn't a multitude, but there were those that followed that. But he managed to get them to commit suicide by convincing them that that would bring them to the spaceship. Advance. So we have these warnings, and what I'm the point we're trying to make here is that we will be criticized. People don't like us. They don't like our church because we have to talk about these things. The churches that people like, or a lot of people like, are where it's all positive, all upbeat. You know, would you ever expect Joel Osteen to talk very much about any of these things? No. He basically admits he's not really much of a Bible teacher. But he gets so many people to come to his stadium, and they love to hear him because you know he's always going to be positive and upbeat and handsome to look at. And just a great experience. But that's not the New Testament. The New Testament is be on guard. Keep on delighting in the Word of God, not in philosophy, not in whatever's popular at the time. Delight in what God has said. This is the truth, and the truth is eternal. And so that's the spirit that I think we'll also see in the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation, you have the historical approach, which is what I take. The other two most common, and there's other approaches too, but the two most common that you'll probably come across if you go online and things is the preterist view of the book of Revelation and the futurist view. And the preterist view came from, anybody know where it came from? Yep, Counter-Reformation. And anybody know where the futurist view came from? Same source, Counter-Reformation. Yeah, the church, the Roman Catholic Church. 1614, Luis de Alcazar came up with the preterist approach. He was a priest. And then two other priests in 1591 came up with the futurist view. Now, this is really clever because they understand there are different personalities. There are personalities who like the preterist view. They like a view that says it's all done, which is what the preterist view says. It says that all of Revelation has been fulfilled, either in the first century or at least by the end of the fourth century. It's all done. Some people like that. They love that. There are lots of Church of Christ preachers that I know about that have take the preterist view. And part of that's because they're reacting to the futurist view. The futurist view is none of Revelation has taken place except for the letters to the seven churches, which a lot of them take as symbolic of seven church ages. Okay? But the futurist view basically says Revelation 6 is the start of the description of the tribulation, 7 years before Jesus comes back and establishes his kingdom on earth, according to their view. And, of course, you run across those who believe that way. They either believe the church will be raptured at the start of the tribulation, or in the middle of the tribulation, or after. You're either pre-trib, mid-trib, or post-trib. The pre-tribs is the most attractive because we don't have to be in on the tribulation. The post-trib, that's for the tough people, you know. No, church has got to go through it too. We got to go through it. We can't be exempt. So, but the most popular is the pre-tribulation. Rapture, and then that great tribulation. Well, that's the futurist view. And what do the futurists and preterist views do very conveniently? If one hasn't even happened yet, and one has already taken place, it's not the Catholic Church. It can't be the Roman Catholic Church, because it was all done in the first century, or it hadn't even happened yet, so it couldn't be talking about the Roman Catholic Church. So that's why they, in the Counter-Reformation, like Wade said, the Counter-Reformation, remember, is when men got the Bible, then they had to change their tactics. If you've got a Bible, I'm going to have to discuss with you on the basis of the Bible. I can't just talk about traditions because you're not going to accept traditions. So the Counter-Reformation was, well, Revelation is actually describing how God destroyed the Jewish nation, or how he destroyed pagan Rome. Some will go that far, but nobody will. They don't want to take the step into, well, what about this great big period, 1260 years? What about that? So just be aware of that. I talked to a brother one time. I asked him what he thought was wrong with the historical approach. He said, well, it just sounds too much like Catholic bashing to me. And so that's why he preferred not to take that view. Wade? Right. Yeah. And it is, it's similar to talking about the Muslims, as Eric said. We must be always careful how we talk about others and remember that we love them, and that, as the book of Revelation says, God says, come out of her, my people. So there's people that are there. We can maybe be the ones to help them come out. We have some in our family that came out of that. Some here in this room have come out of it. So that's the way we look at it. And if we always try to maintain that attitude, it will help keep us from sounding like we're just being mean to people we disagree with. Wait. Yeah. That is true. Very true. Yeah. I've seen that too, Wade. That's a good point. And along with that, as we've said before, they seem to appreciate the truth more sometimes than we do. So we love them. But we have to look what's Satan's tactic going to be to keep us from going to heaven. And his best tactics are to join us and to put himself off as a Christian, or even as the leader of all Christians. That's pretty daring, pretty bold approach. And we can do that without being mean towards our neighbors and those that we know that are still in the Roman Catholic Church. Very good point. So just to kind of summarize, I believe that Revelation chapter 6 begins right after John wrote. John wrote in about 96 or 98. A.D., right at the end of the first century, and he talks about a white horse with a rider on it. The rider has the bow in his hand, and I believe, now a lot of commentators say that's Jesus and the church, and I see why they say that, but I think there's more, to me, there's more evidence to point to the Roman Empire, because that's consistent with the red horse that follows, the black horse and the pale horse and the black horse that follow. those are all assigned to the Roman Empire, and I think that the white horse should be too. And it really does fit, because after John wrote, for about 100 years, the Roman Empire enjoyed her greatest period of time. Historians call that the golden age of the Roman Empire, right after John wrote. Which is good to know, because if the Roman Empire is going to fall, for a while it doesn't look like they are. Well, we're just getting bigger and bigger all the time. We're becoming greater and more powerful. You sure? You sure the Roman Empire is going to fall? Think about the United States. Usually, we don't like to think of the United States ever falling. And for somebody to tell us that can or will happen, I don't think so. I think we're too strong. But yet we look in history, we see the strong Roman Empire. It eventually fell. But for a while after John wrote, it didn't look like it would. It was going good, going great, had good strong leaders. And again, keep in mind 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians 2 is a very brief summary of what's going to happen over the next hundreds of years. Paul says, don't let anybody disturb you. Jesus isn't coming unless there has to be a falling away first in order for Jesus to come. And that's going to take place over a while. Although Paul does say the mystery of iniquity is already working. And I believe it's already working in like Diotrephes and the men that Paul warned about in Acts 20. Of your own selves, men will rise up, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them. That's the mystery of iniquity. And eventually, they're going to draw away many to this idea that there is one head on earth of the church, when the New Testament says there's only one head. He's in heaven. None of us are the head of the church, and we can never be. But many were drawn away to that idea. So the sixth chapter of Roman or Revelation, to summarize it, is about the fall of pagan Rome. And the end of that chapter talks about people saying to the rocks and the hills, fall on us. I believe that's a description of how awful you would have felt if you were a pagan. If you were a pagan, the pagans looked at this as a judgment from the gods. They said, we must have really done something wrong to lose out like this. Remember, the 4th century culminates in the emperor of Rome proclaiming to be a Christian. It's just incredible. How did that ever happen? How did the leader of Rome ever go from pagan to Christian? Just amazing. Eldon? Oh, yeah. 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 I agree, Eldon. And if you'll notice, there's a wording there that's in 2 Thessalonians 2 that's also found in the Daniel passage that Wade referred to. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 8. The King James says, and then shall that wicked be revealed. That's the man of sin. Whom the Lord will consume with the spirit of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. So what has happened right now is the man of sin has been consumed with the spirit of his mouth. That's the Bible. The Bible's what consumed him. Now, that doesn't mean it destroyed him. He's not gone like the devil. He's not gone. But he will be finally destroyed with the brightness of his coming. So that's why he's still around. He's been revealed to anybody who's wise enough and who reads the Bible. He's been revealed that way, and he's like Eric was saying yesterday, kind of like the emperor with no clothes on. It's a similar situation here if you know the Bible. If you don't know the Bible, you're like the rest of the people, go, oh, doesn't he look wonderful? Oh, isn't he nice? They marvel at him. They look forward to when he comes to visit our city. He may come to our city. Can you believe that? He's going to come here. They marvel at him. But if you know the Word of God, you're not scared of it. You're not afraid of the heathen. You're not afraid of the idolatry and those things, because you know what God says. So, yes, Eldon, that's right. He's been revealed, but his influence still remains. And to what extent it will continue to influence the world, I'm not sure. He still enjoys great popularity. But as to how much influence he can wield, see, the Word of God took away that influence that the man of sin once had. He once had great influence. He could divide the world. Imagine if you got to divide the world. Elder? That's right. Yeah, and like Lewis was talking about last night, Satan will change tactics. If he can persecute us, if he can keep the Bible away from us, he'll work with that. But if he can't keep the Bible from us, he's got tactics with that too. He can take our reward away from us, even if we have a house full of Bibles. He's got ways to do that too. Lewis? Excellent point. Paul describes it in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 3, as the simplicity of the gospel. It's so nice how he set it up. It's so simple. Our assemblies are so simple. They're not supposed to be pomp and ceremony. We're here to hear what God says. We're here to honor him and worship him. We're here to show forth the Lord's death till he comes. This is why we're here. We love one another. It's just so simple. And so we should be thankful we can do that. And thankful we live in a country that we can do it in public. We don't have to hide this meeting this week. We don't have to hide the regular assemblies of the congregation here. We don't have to hide them. So we've got to, and they're like Eldon and Lewis are saying, we have to take heed because Satan has tactics if we can meet like this. You know, so be careful. Now back to Revelation. Revelation 6, to summarize, as I understand it, is about how pagan Rome crumbles on the inside. Now, it hasn't fallen yet. It's not until chapter 8. Chapter 7 is about how God is protecting his people. That's the summary I would give of that. The sealing of the 144,000. Don't worry about all these bad things that happen. If you're faithful to God, you're protected. So don't be afraid of these things. The eighth chapter describes the fall of the Roman Empire. And I love that eighth chapter from this standpoint. I wasn't really convinced of the historical view. It was the one I was taught, but I wasn't really convinced of it until I taught it myself. And in order to teach it, you have to look at history, which not always what everybody wants to do. Thomas likes doing it, but a lot of people say, history, ugh. So until you read history, and a brother recently, I was talking to him about the book Revelation in a congregation, and he said, "No, I can't accept that view." He says, "You don't have to have another book to understand the Bible." Well, that's true when it comes to the doctrine. I agree on that. But when it comes to prophecy, there are lots of prophecies that are not explained in the Bible. Lots of prophecies in the Old Testament were not explained there. You have to read historians to find out, well, I wonder if that really did come to pass with Tyre. I wonder if that really did happen. History will confirm it. And so if Revelation is the last book of the Bible, we are not waiting for God to write another book. We're not going to get another explanation of history. We have to read the history, see if it confirms. And when I read Will Durant, who is a simple historian, I would consider easy to read. You don't get all the details that other historians get. But I like Will Durant when he wrote about the fall of the Roman Empire. He wrote it just like it's symbolized here in Revelation 8, and it only took up like that much room on the page. He says, first of all, Alaric the Goths came down, then the Vandals came, then Attila the Hun came, and then the Heruli came. Just like the symbols are here, it really fit. And it was just, like I said, that big a paragraph. Just bang, 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 bang. The four angels that are sounding in this eighth chapter. That leads you to the ninth chapter, which I believe is the Muslim chapter, and it ties into what we're talking about today, I think. Because the first part talks about the origin of Muhammad. Muhammad, I believe, is the star who fell from heaven. star represents somebody who rules. Was Muhammad a ruler? Well, to start with, he was going to be. His parents ruled, but his father died, and then his grandfather died, and they cut Muhammad out of the line. To me, that goes along with Acts chapter 8. What was maybe Simon the sorcerer's problem? Simon the sorcerer had been a big guy. And that may have been why he came to the apostle and said, what do you want for that ability? I'll give you money for it. And he says, I perceive you're in the gall of bitterness. And I wonder if that was a part of Muhammad's motivation, that he was in the gall of bitterness, thinking about, I could have been king. I could have been the leader. And Satan provided him with a way to become a great leader. And he's still leading today. It's incredible, this story. And I believe, and we don't want to go into that today, but just that's what I view the ninth chapter. And I think it ties in this sense today. It talks after Muhammad goes out and does his, after Muhammad's gone. It talks about these four angels down in verse 15 of chapter 9, chapter 14, or verse 14. The sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. Loose them. Let them go. The great river Euphrates. The great river,
the Euphrates. That's cool. Not a thing. Whoever's behind this river, loose it. And when we talk about Gog and Magog, and Lewis talked about this in his life, Gog and Magog is going to point to people up here. That's where we're going to be. And they've already come down. Like Lewis said, they came down in the form of the Seleucid Empire on Israel. And before the end of time, if we put some literal application there, we may be talking about the same group of people.